So Rebecca, emails and ethics conversations, what do you say?
I'm in.
Upper tier patron Kelsey Hawk, they said, could the need for fast-paced content be detrimental to young kids' attention spans?
Yes.
More so than TV, what do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I see how my own teen is wired now, cannot have a single screen experience. Cannot just watch TV, is constantly on their phone and watching TV. I mean, they're doing fine in their life. At some point, it gets turned off. But the amount of stimulation that is normal to them, it's a lot. It's got to impact how our brains are wired. And we know it impacts the pleasure centers. And we also know how much it impacts kids' self-esteem. I mean, Seattle Public Schools is currently attempting to sue Snapchat or one of those companies to say how detrimental the amount of social media presence is for kids. And part of it is that it's relentless. You know, you see a body type over and over and over again that's not yours.
Mm-hmm.
It's not good.
Yeah. This is a complicated issue, but in a nutshell, their research is such that it's mixed. So on the good side of the current landscape of stimulation to kids, because it's been ever increasing over time, right? Before cell phones, you had commercials that were edited very quickly, and before that, you had something else. So it's been something that's been researched for a long time, and the research has been continuing to see any sort of effect of the current landscape. But so on the good side, what we can say is that kids are smarter today than they ever were before. You know, things involving attention, working memory, cognitive focus. So the idea that the children of today have some sort of cognitive negative effect is not borne out in the data. Now, it's hard to know why, on average, kids all over the world are more intelligent, meaning better attention span, better working memory, better cognition. There's a lot of factors, nutrition, better conditions for children, more education, more access to information, that kind of thing, the Flynn effect. But there is some evidence that the sort of things that kids participate in, video games included, actually help them in a lot of realms. Like, one of the things about social media is there's a lot of reading. Mm-hmm. You know, you read a lot and you type a lot. And remember when we were kids,
you never typed.
Yeah, there was hardly.
You had to take a typing class.
Or at the very least, when you put pen to paper, it would be rare, especially mm-hmm. when you're in the second grade, right? There's not a lot of writing things down. It would be doing homework. You know, I remember, maybe you remember this too, Rebecca, that after summer vacation, I would go back to school and I wouldn't know how to write my name because the entire summer I hadn't read or written a single word. And so, for kids, you know, that's just one dimension of verbal comprehension, that kind of thing, the ability to process a lot of information. You know, you use it, you don't lose it, that kind of thing. So stimulation. And there's a lot of myths, like this idea of attention spans getting shorter. There's a lot of research on this because there have been a lot of claims along these lines. Like, a common thing that you will hear is that children today have attention spans that are X amount of seconds shorter. I don't know if you remember when we were teenage and in our 20s, there was this notion about the MTV generation.
Oh, yes. We were doomed.
Yeah. And how our attention spans were only 7 seconds long or something like this. Do you remember that?
No, but I remember the idea that we watched 3-minute long videos was just going to destroy us.
Yeah, right. And the editing of these videos was very quick as well. And the notion was that it was rotting our brains.
And look how intelligent we are now.
There's just no evidence that our attention spans are getting shorter. Plus, it's hard to know how to measure it, an attention span, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things you can look at, but what does that mean? And when you reduce these to some scary news headline of like, kids today have attention spans that are 12 seconds instead of 20 seconds when I was a kid, it just feels right. It sort of slots into this notion that kids are idiots today. That's been something throughout history. Well, I remember when I was in the fourth grade, literally looking at second graders and saying, kids today don't know how to respect their elders. Because when I was in second grade, I respected the fourth graders. Anyway, so, you know, there's a lot of different myths out there. Now, you mentioned some very obvious things that can be measured, not necessarily cognition, intelligence, attention span, but
anxiety, depression.
Yeah, those are measurable effects
and
as well.
Those are off the charts right now.
Right. We don't know how to know the cause, but, you know, it seems pretty obvious that isolation, social comparison, online bullying, body dysmorphia, all those things.
Lack of social connection.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you know, how we defined ourselves as teens were kind of hours lying on the floor with our peers talking, self-regulating, co-regulating with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And now the amount of time that, and unmonitored, right? Mm-hmm. You often tell stories of like wandering in the woods. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, how many hours did I spend making ant traps that didn't work out of like soap and yogurt containers? And
I mean, I literally don't think I was monitored for a single minute of my entire childhood. I mean, I might have been around my parents at times, well, but I don't think they were even monitoring me then.
And I don't know if I've told this story, but when I was in seventh grade, my mom, I was going to Berkeley Public Schools, but my dad lived in South San Francisco. My high school, my junior high was Willard Junior High. My mom left and I was staying with my dad, and I had to get from my dad's house to my middle school. And of course, I didn't ask any adult what would be the best way to do that. So I just got on BART at my dad's stop, got off at MacArthur Station. You can MapQuest this.
BART's a train, right?
BART's a mass transportation. And then I walked from MacArthur Station to my junior high. And like, you know, it never crossed my mind, like maybe there's a bus. And I remember one day I ran into a kid that I went to school with, and he was like, "What are you doing? And I described my whole journey, and they were like, "That's insane." You're traveling.
Was there a bus that went by?
Probably. Somebody can probably MapQuest this now. And or MapQuest, I'm so old, whatever. I'm sure there was a bus. My middle school is on a major street. But like, no one figured it out for me, right? I just kind of like used the knowledge that I had.
And you knew you had enough confidence in yourself that you were like, well, I'll figure something out.
Right. Walked, yeah. I don't know, 3 miles.
Yeah. And the amount of self-esteem that you have, and this is well understood as well, that helicopter parenting, which is a different issue, of course, than social media, results in children lacking self-esteem, lacking self-confidence, lacking this sense of themselves as capable human beings who can accomplish things on their own, a much more likelihood that they think of themselves as a failure and dependent on other people. And, you know, I'm all for protecting your children from harm, of course, but in the same way that you can't, or it's not recommended that you create a sterile environment so that child is never exposed to anything early in life that will help them to, you know, not develop allergies to certain things. You also want to have a little bit of real life, you know, getting their hands in the dirt, so to speak, letting them do things on their own. It's scary, but, you know, it's not bad parenting the way some people will say. Anyway, so yeah, I would say that overall, social media, at this point, we don't know everything, and we probably never will, because the only way we could know more precise effects of social media is if we literally took thousands of children and raised them in a bubble and had a group of children that had social media and a group of kids that didn't, and then you would see the differences. So we're left with large-scale studies that might be identifying effects of different things in the world. But my take is that it's something that's always been present with raising children. There's always things that are impacting them, both positive and negative. And the key is to be attuned to your child, because children, generally speaking, when they have a good relationship, sure, they like social media, they like the internet, but they're still human beings. They want to interact with other humans in person. That's what we evolved for. There's a lot of flashing lights. There's a lot of propensity to addiction, and some kids might have a greater disposition of that. But if you're raising kids, or just all of us, really, I mean, kids, all of us are potentially affected negatively by social media. But the key is that we have in-person, attached, secure, connected relationships with people. And then whatever effects that social media might have, it will be mitigated by
real life.
That foundation, yeah.
Right. I mean, when I look at, when I look at everybody's having a fun day, blah, 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 and then I hear everybody's real story of what's really going on in their lives, at least as an adult, I can understand the difference of that. But, you know, especially in the year that I've had, I've learned so much about how co-regulating with people in the present moment is probably the thing I need most.
Mm-hmm.
I really look forward to the times that we get to podcast mm-hmm. together because, like, I'm sitting with you and looking with you and laughing with you and getting really funny texts from you before I arrive. And I won't even say what the last one was, but it was not what I was expecting on my way in the door. this is what humans are wired for. Mm-hmm. We are not really wired enough to understand these kind of short snippets of everyone else's life looks happy and mine feels shitty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially for kids who haven't had a ton of experiences of ups and downs. And high school is obviously a complete disaster for everyone, but having watched my kid their first year out of high school and watching like what friends have circled back and said, you know, I've made some mistakes. Do you still like me? Like, it's really sweet.
Hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's another thing. To me, anecdotally, kids today are much more emotionally healthy than we were when mm-hmm. we were kids. So there's something that's going right in our society.
Well, it's the social emotional learning and the diversity, equity, and inclusion education that naturally happens in most schools.
Yeah. So this notion of like kids today are their brains are being rotted. I don't see that.
No. I mean, if you've spent any time with your average high schooler, they are more socially aware. Oh, they're aware of everything. Like my mind is blown by the conversations that I've had with 16, 17, 18 year olds these days. Like they are, the kids, they're too all right. They understand too much of what's happening.
Yeah. So Rebecca, you wanted to talk about ethics.
I need your help.
What's the question?
Oh, it's big. Okay. So let me, so my one day or tarot and therapy, mm-hmm. Cascadia has requested a three-dayer.
So you do classes mm-hmm. to therapists?
Yes.
Teaching them how to use tarot cards and tarot, I don't know if
you concepts.
Just concepts in therapy with clients.
Yes.
And you've already been doing that.
2 years now, it's
and
hard
you
to believe.
Make your own tarot cards with
I through collage and ephemera, we make tarot cards to, it's purely art-based learning. It's
and if
a
people
blast.
Want to sign up for this, this is an in-person class.
Or online, it's Cascadia Trainings.
Okay. Cascadia.com, Rebecca Bloom.
Cascadia Trainings, yeah. I think it's CascadiaTrainings.com. Okay.
So you have questions about ethics.
Right. So they've bumped me up from a one-dayer. I'll continue to do the one-dayers, but I'm going to be doing a three-dayer, which is pretty amazing. And in order for them to like be able to do the CEUs that they need to do, I need to do 4 hours of ethics content in my tarot presentation. So there's a 1 hour that's really clear, which is what are all people's fears about using tarot in therapy, which really there's no ethical issue. But I've learned as an art therapist, I give myself way more permission to play in the session and try things out with clients. Does therapy have to be evidence-based? But I've never taught an ethics graduate class or an ethics CEU, and I think I'm in the minority of my friends who've taught graduate school.
I would say it's rare that you'll have a professor.
Oh.
I've never taught an ethics
course. Oh, really?
Course. Yeah. It's not really something I'm super interested in teaching anyway. Mm-hmm. Well, God, you know, when I think about it, now that I review all the people that taught ethics, a lot of them were kind of roped into it because it's not
one wants to teach this.
It's not a sexy topic.
No.
So
it's very dry.
Usually it's foisted on someone and they're like, oh, okay, fine. And as soon as they can, they get out of that mm-hmm. gig. Yeah, there's not a lot of specialists in ethics that you can find. I mean, I suppose you can pull in someone from the outside who's like a lawyer or something.
Right. And there's a guy in town that's both a lawyer and a therapist, and he has this market locked down.
Yeah, I can't remember his name.
Eric
something. Yeah, Eric something. But I also have, my lawyer is a social worker and now an attorney, and so she knows all sorts of stuff along these. She specializes in therapy, ethics, and legal stuff, and has been to court a lot. That's always the key, is like, if you have a teacher in ethics, what you want to ask them is, how many times have you actually litigated? How many times have you actually defended someone or prosecuted someone? Because the closer you are to that actual activity, the more you will actually have accurate information, because that's where the decisions are made, right?
Well, and therapists fear that they are being unethical. I don't know if this is true in other professions, but the amount of conversations I have with my peers that they are in the wrong. They must be in the wrong. They must have done it wrong. And so I'm kind of fascinated how we always land that we're doing it badly.
Yeah.
Which we're often not. I mean, come on, if you're not sleeping with your client or like embezzling from your client, you're doing great.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, there's two things. One is that people are overly paranoid.
Right.
Like, they'll think that they're going to go to jail, literally, if they accept a $5 Starbucks card, you know, during the holidays. And yes, it's not something you want to get into a practice of, and you should probably turn it down if you can. But if, for example, someone's crying as they're giving you this gift card, it's like, this is, you know, it would mean so much if you could just accept this from me. I really want to pay you back. And I know that you're not supposed to accept, you know, they really lay it on thick. It would be really, you know, counter to treatment in the relationship for you to just be like, sorry, I am an ethical robot. You will not do that. I have to refuse. You know, the literature and the precedent is such that it totally allows for flexibility. It's not a rule set. It's a set of considerations and decision-making practices.
And I don't know if I've told you this story, but on my last, the last question on my LMHC exam, which was before I was pregnant with Eli, so 20 years ago, but I still remember it crystal clear. The last question is, you are working with a Chinese client. They give you a gift. Do you accept it? And I remember thinking at
the time. What the fuck?
Well, I know what they were getting at, which is, it is
all Chinese people. Right. Literally over a billion people. Everyone's the same.
But it was also, it was, do you know your cultural competency and your ethics piece? Which is, cultural competency at the time would have been accept the gift. It is what you're supposed to be doing. I know, you're rolling your eyes like crazy. But it's just funny that, like, I don't remember. No, there was also a question about the fourth step in AA, which was also seared in my mind.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is about making amends, I think. Okay. But, yeah, so I just think it was interesting that, you know, there are cultural considerations.
Yeah.
And all of that. But that question was like seared into my mind. And then in the moment was like all of this back and forth. Like, I know what I would do. And I was working in an all Asian agency at the time where clients would bring in lavish 4-course meals to share with the clinicians.
Yeah.
So the idea that, like, you know, we're not talking $5 gift card. We're talking an entire roasted pig on a giant piece of cardboard that has come into the office for everyone to enjoy. Like, the level of gift giving was insane.
Yeah.
So it was just so interesting that I'm like doing this beep, boop, boop, boop. You know, I'm like trying to figure it out in my head. Like, I know what I would do. I know what my agency has done and will always do. Here I am in a constricted exam that decides whether or not I get licensed.
But there's literally a right or wrong answer to that question. That the notion of that is ridiculous. And it just highlights, just side note, how ridiculous those tests are.
Yeah. I did pass, by the way.
Yeah, good. So, some of the questions, especially the ethical questions, I will read and I'll just be like, that is just not even the case. I mean, the people who come up with these questions, one, they seemingly don't know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And two, the people who are taking the test really don't know what they're doing. So no one will speak out against it. And there's, where do you go to complain about these licensing tests? There's no recourse. It's not like you can choose.
No, you can't do anything.
You can't choose a different test.
Right.
There's one test.
Yeah.
And it's this power structure that just dominates, and it leads to misunderstanding about ethics. The other element that I will see among a lot of clinicians, I would say the vast majority, is that when in doubt, they will say something's unethical.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, what do we do? Is this ethical or is that ethical? They'll be like, oh, that's unethical. Because I think for them, they're hedging all of their bets.
Right.
They're like, well, it's easier to restrict myself than to learn actual ethical decision making and consult with people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's socially more safe. It's sort of like, I remember when I was in high school, I loved certain things. Like, I loved Depeche Mode, and I loved,
of course you did,
running in the rain. And I remember being exuberant about certain things, and insecure. I don't know what was wrong with these peers of mine, but seemingly insecure. I would be exuberant, not bothering anybody, just like, hey, I love this thing. And from the side, they would put me down. They'd mm-hmm. be like, oh, what, that thing's stupid. It's so much easier to hate something. So
yeah.
It's the same thing. It's so much easier to call something unethical than to actually look into it. And I would say 99 times out of 100 online, when people are saying something's unethical, it's literally not unethical. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing. But let me ask you about the landscape here. So you're tasked with giving them official CEUs, continuing education
yeah.
units, on ethics. So you give them a certificate at the end of this saying you have completed how many hours of ethics
training? Three or four.
Three or four hours of ethics training. And these are clinicians.
Mm-hmm.
And you can probably teach anything on ethics as long
right.
as it's ethical content. But if it's specific to tarot...
So let me pose it to you this way.
Okay.
I've got 1 hour solid of content of why it's okay to do tarot and therapy.
Okay.
Jungian, what is evidence-based really in a culturally competent world, blah, blah, blah. I've got another great exercise at the end for people to explore their personal ethics using tarot. I've got 2 hours. If you could make teaching ethics really fun and interesting and engaging for 2 hours, what should I do?
Well, I gave it some thought and I took some notes. So
I am taking notes on your notes.
Well, I mean, I'll send you this outline.
Okay.
So you don't have to take notes on all of it. But so I am going off the ACA Code mm-hmm. of Ethics, which is, I'm guessing, at least most of your trainees,
yeah,
the counselors, MHC people. So the first thing, and I just read your ethical codes and just went through and pulled out what is relevant, I think, to the training. Number one is informed consent.
Mm-hmm.
So all the normal disclosures need to occur, of course, but additionally with clients. So we have this ethical guideline, dear listeners, that is such that as clinicians, we have to give enough information to the potential client before they even engage with us so that they can consent to treatment with proper information. They are informed as they give consent. So not only do we have to inform them, but we also have to get consent. And we have to make sure that they are properly informed, the clients, of the treatment modality, any relevant research, risks, what the treatment can and cannot do. And there's a lot of different practices here, but generally speaking, you know, given what you were saying earlier about evidence base and this sort of thing, there's a lot of, you know, forms of therapy that are not technically considered evidence based, but they could be subsumed under what we would call the standard of practice. There is a standard of practice within Jungian psychology and therapy that involves a lot of the things within tarot. So if you were to be sued, for example, and I would even talk about this, like say you use tarot and someone dies by suicide and you end up getting sued, you know, that would be a potential thing that could happen. you know, say you have a client that dies by suicide and the family, and it's not your fault, and you're using Tarot occasionally with that client, but the family is out to get you, mm-hmm. and they sue you and identify, look what they're doing. They're using magical demon cards. And if you have, one, a written policy about the, and literature to back up, mm-hmm. I mean, is there literature on this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So having literature that can demonstrate the standard of practice, that you have guidelines, that it doesn't involve the devil and that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. And also that it could be, you know, subsumed under the larger umbrella of a long tradition called Jungian therapy. And so not only do I have that backing and that foundation that can demonstrate I wasn't acting outside of the industry, I was mm-hmm. actually within the standard of practice. And then two, I informed the client of this, not only in writing, but also as I show you the signed document that the client signed. And two, I had a brief conversation with them at the beginning of therapy of what all this means and where this therapy is considered within the larger realm of therapy, and it was appropriate for the issue at hand, you mm-hmm. know. So informed consent, that involves a lot of things. It's a lot of homework, some forms, understanding of how to communicate about this. The vast majority of therapists in my anecdotal experience don't do this well. Mm-hmm. It's hard, you know. Now, the benefit is for you and your students is you can actually do this for yourself mm-hmm. and just give them the paragraph and say, if you want to use this paragraph in your disclosure, then go ahead and plagiarize it. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? That's a benefit of being in this course. Or if you want to modify it a little bit here and there, of course, you can do that. But here's a guideline, because your students are going to look at you pretty glassy-eyed when you tell them about informed consent. There's, you know, they'll get anxious and they'll be like, I don't want to be in this class anymore. So if you just hand them the paragraph.
So we're doing that day two.
Okay.
But do that day one, everyone will get too focused on it.
And then there should be an intake note that is written, a sentence of like, we went verbally over the evidence and the appropriateness of this model of Tarot. And, you know, of course, the therapists aren't just using Tarot. They're using a lot of other different techniques, right? You know, there's a lot of things they're doing. So that's one, informed consent. That's a big area. The other one is personal values. So not imposing our beliefs on our clients. And it could be considered a belief system that could be considered forced on a client if it wasn't done right. Mm-hmm. Now, presumably, everyone understands, but you should be explicit as you're teaching the course, that you have a brief conversation with clients about that they want this.
Right. You know? Well, yeah. I mean, and also when I present, I say who to not do this with, right? Like if a client is the prominent, predominant presenting factor is psychosis, I don't do tarot with them.
Okay.
It's too overwhelming. And if their clients, if their value system, if their religious value system says that, you know, an aspect of personal divination like tarot isn't appropriate, I don't do it with them. Mm-hmm. And then finally, if a client believes that it is only the Romani people that should have access to tarot cards, I don't do tarot with them. Mm-hmm.
Right. And how do you navigate that? You have a client, for example, and I would go over examples like this, that because I'm guessing the trainees are going to have clients that will come into their office not knowing that the clinician, as an aspect of their practice, will use Tarot. And mm-hmm. so how do you broach the topic and navigate that? Because a client could feel pressured, especially if you come across as a clinician like this is a particular enjoyable thing for the clinician, you know.
Right.
So how do you offer it up as an option while not pressuring them? That's, you know, it's a very delicate kind of thing. Now, if you advertise yourself as a Tarot therapist and they come to you because they mm-hmm. want to, then you don't have to have that conversation.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting too, I mean, I'm looking around your office and I know you don't see clients in here, but it says very much who you are. Hmm. And my office is similar. I have two gigantic dragon puppets. I have a fully articulated owl puppet whose head actually like mostly spins around. I have a gigantic overstuffed octopus. Like there are things in my office that are like, huh, like we might just not talk here. You know, I have an entire bowl that's sitting there of fidget toys. Like, you know, there's art supplies right when you sit down. Mm. And a lot of my decks are on display. I think I own like 45 decks at this point. I think there are maybe 15 at the office. But clients will, my client base in particular is so hypervigilant. Like they will notice, oh, you got a new deck. What's that deck? Can I look at that deck with you? Or sometimes a title will pop out. Like, I have this deck. It's not a tarot deck. It's an oracle deck. And it's just famous artists of the last century. And, you know, clients will see Basquiat or, you know, they'll see Georgia O'Keeffe on the box and they'll say, oh, what's that?
That's how you pronounce. I thought it was Basquiat. No?
Basquiat. This is where Google would come in handy. I probably said it wrong.
I don't know. I mean, you're an artist, so I would assume you're right and I'm wrong.
It's probably Basquiat. You know, my dyslexia and my hearing loss, I'm not the greatest pronunciator.
Yeah. So that is part of the advertising, if you will, or invitation into not only tarot, but also art therapy and hands-on therapies that you will utilize. At the same time, you know, I hear horror stories of clients that will tell me that their therapist offered something up and the client felt like they were being impolite mm-hmm. by turning it down and they went along with it and they mm-hmm. didn't like anything about it. I mean, this includes all the things we're talking about, but also engaging in like body work mm-hmm. and other kinds of invasive things to a client. So it just saying, hey, there's this thing called tarot. Would you like to do it? And the client says, yes, that is not sufficient mm-hmm. in understanding whether or not a client is truly wanting to do something like this. So, you know, like one thing that I might throw out there is that you would say, hey, you know, what you're talking about here lends itself to this other modality of therapy, and I'm going to suggest it, but there are other things we could do to address this, and I don't want to pressure you to do it, but it might be worth exploring. And if you like it, then we can continue. And if you don't, then we won't.
Well, and that's also a brief therapy exercise that art therapy really embraces, which is at the end of any directive, any art-based intervention that I'm doing with people, I will always ask, what did you think of this exercise? And it gives your client yet another chance to say, I liked it or I didn't like it. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest ways that clients tell you that they like something is when they want to take it home or they want to take a picture of what happened. And yeah. I would say 90% of the times that I pull tarot cards with clients, they want to take a picture because something happened.
Yeah, you can usually, hopefully as a therapist, if you're paying attention enough and you're not overly internally pressured to make people do things that you like to do as opposed to attending to the client, you're going to notice when a client is getting into something mm-hmm. and you'll intuit like, oh, okay, I get energy from them right now that they like this. So that's another thing. I might also suggest like a tech, because I've done lots of experimental, you know, things that aren't necessarily known to clients, like chair work and this kind of thing. And what I will do with clients is I will do a little taste of it and then I'll say, so if you ever want to do this again, mm-hmm. you tell me. Mm-hmm. And if you don't bring it up again, then I'm fine. I might throw it out there maybe, but I want clients to be in the driver's seat, because even if we do it the way that, you know, we're talking about earlier, where it's just like you just intuit or even ask them, they could still feel like they need to please me, especially with some kind of client. So anyway.
Well, and I think you just mentioned the gestalt empty chair technique, which I just did yesterday. And it feels like that's a technique I do all the time. But I had a really interesting experience doing it with a client yesterday who has incredibly complicated and amazing family history. And their mother is still alive. And there's this huge issue going on with their mom. And their mom's in denial of what it all means. And I just said to her, if you could say anything, if you could just let it rip, if you could just, you know, this is also remote. So I'm learning, like I had to learn how to introduce the empty chair technique when neither of us are in the same room and there is no empty chair. to say, if you could just let it rip and just say what you really wanted to say to your mom, what would you say? And she just let it all out. And she was like, oh, that felt really good. Why did that feel good? And I explained the Gestalt empty chair technique, right? This is a technique that's been used in therapy now, I don't know.
50 years.
Yeah, a very, probably longer than that.
Probably
like 80 years. And she was like, why did that feel good? And I could say, well, you got to be honest. You know, whether you could ever really say that to your mother, some part of you just really needed to let that go. And we have this special experience in here, not in here, because we're both in separate places, but that you were witnessed in that.
Mm-hmm.
I heard you say it, and I will remember what you really wanted to say to your mom. Mm-hmm. And like, that's therapy, right? Mm-hmm. Like that truth got told, that person didn't get rejected, that they got to say the thing without judgment from their family. Like, you know, I mean, those are those nuggets that I, as a clinician, I just live for it.
Yeah, me too. The transformational power of empty chair and parts work is obvious and profound. I mean, some of the biggest moments of my life, let alone as a therapist, have been using empty chair, not only with clients, but with students. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll demonstrate it to students, and half the students will just be having like this mind-blowing experience. And so let's take a break. When we get back, okay, Let's continue.
All right.
All right, we're back from the break. Okay, so let me just rattle through the next bits here. Pretty obvious things coming up. The next thing in your code of ethics is confidentiality, which I know you are very adamant about this, that people don't share online, for example, a client's art or a client's tarot card reading, right? So you could see how someone might have an impulse for that, and maybe even a client might even verbally agree to that. But generally speaking, unless there's an absolute necessary reason to do that, which I can imagine why there would be, client information, including the tarot reading, should be kept confidential. And you just probably want to emphasize that as an obvious thing. Then the other thing is documentation. How does one document this? And I don't know the answer to that, honestly, because I haven't been in this realm before. I can't imagine it being too complicated, but I would imagine that you would want to have something that, you know, we spent half the session today doing tarot, and here was the purpose, and the client said X about it.
I mean, and just so people know, the way I would document, I would say, you know, we were playing with archetypal imagery. We were playing with Jungian concepts around the dark side of us. And, you know, we were playing with the shadow side.
Okay.
So I document completely using Jungian language or using mindfulness.
Okay.
That we were working on, you know, self-acceptance. We were working on lessening anxiety symptoms. Okay. And there are tons of tarot cards that are about kind of really intense, powerful sources of us for personal knowledge. And those are all mindfulness concepts in my idea.
That's great. That's very great, because if someone were to read it, if they were scrutinizing or suing you, the language would look very clinical. Mm-hmm. It would be buttoned up. You could justify it. It would be related to common therapy tasks and the goal of therapy. Whereas if you said, you know, this happened with the tarot and the client said that they now know their future or something, that could open yourself up to a pretty large liability, because that's not within the standard of practice to predict the future. And it's not within the standard of practice. You used mindfulness, self-esteem, and Jungian standard of practice to frame what you're doing, which I think is important. I'm guessing a lot of your trainees won't be Jungian. I don't know. But if they're not, you know, giving them other way, maybe even throwing it out there to them, it's like, who in here is not Jungian, and tell me what modality you're typically using. You know, you might be, you could be starting from scratch with some of these people, because like I was saying earlier, a lot of therapists
are no longer Jungian. What are they doing?
Well, what do you mean? What?
Now I feel old. I feel so old.
Oh, well, not just Jungian, but just terrible at documentation. Mm-hmm. A lot of therapists, they don't know how to word things in their notes to be non-liable to themselves. You know, they don't know how to word things like this was, you know, the way you laid it out very quickly.
I don't know why I'm so good at that. I've always been really good at that. Not to toot my own horn or anything. But, you know, I mean, clinicians can really get stuck in the weeds of like trying to describe in a paragraph. And I'm just like, oh my God, you were just increasing self-esteem. Like, move on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've always been the master of the super brief summary.
Use that skill when you're teaching this, because that's a huge part of ethical practice. Mm-hmm. And very helpful to your students, I'm sure.
So let me just talk this through, because you're my, this is gold. So I could see doing a mock session, doing a fishbowl session. Mm.
And then saying, okay, how do you word it?
Right. And then asking everybody to come up with a one sentence summary.
Yeah.
That would be.
Yes.
That would be really great.
Yeah, exactly. And or what I do with people is think about the last session you had and just tell me in one sentence what you did in a way that won't get you sued.
Yeah.
One sentence with no semicolons, you know, just a regular subject, verb, object.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
You know,
let me
just
write this down.
Tell me.
Subject.
And you'll get
verb,
six object. Out of 10 people that'll panic and they'll write nothing. And another three will have terrible sentences and one person will kind of be okay. So it's a skill just baseline, and then you can go from there and actually how to write a good note intro. And your students will love you because of this, because that's a very useful skill. Mm-hmm. And also, how do you write it quickly?
Yeah.
You know, the way you're laying it out is the way I do it, which is like you cut to the chase, you get to the foundation, and you write one sentence and you move on with the rest of your day. Mm-hmm. You're going to be writing thousands of notes in your entire career.
No one will read 99% of them.
But the one time when someone does read it, it better be buttoned up. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and also I think that...
You're burping.
I'm burping. Sorry, everyone. I was fed cheese on my way in by the host. So it's their fault that I'm burping. But I did ask for the cheese. So really, that was super passive aggressive in Seattleite.
Yeah. And he had to reach into my pocket to get
it. Yeah, which was very odd. And he had slightly opened the cheese stick. It was maybe the most intimate
moment. Oh, wait. It was open? The cheese stick was open?
Yes.
Oh, that's because...
It was closed. It was like resealed.
So Rebecca comes into my house. She's like, I need a string cheese. And I'm like, okay. And then I'm like, wait, I don't know if we have any. Because we don't eat string cheese. It's for the dogs. it's high value treats, they call it.
Yes, the cheese tax.
So I went into the fridge to look where there might be some string cheese. And there was one that was moldy.
Oh, well, I'm thankful that you didn't feed me that.
And I threw that one away. And there's another one. And it looked close, but it looks like, I mean, was there a chunk taken out of it?
No, it looked like there was, it was, I thought you were being, so just so everyone knows, like Kirk, I'm sure you would guess this already, is like the most unbelievable host. So like you arrive and there's like a water bottle and there's a pillow and like, you know, there's this way in which I feel very cared for. As a co-host. And for those of you, anyways.
I don't ever have any food is the thing. I don't have any snacks.
Well, and I asked for the cheese stick and the first thing you hand me is dog treats. And I was like, I asked for cheese.
So to back that up, Rebecca is in the bathroom. I get the cheese and my dog is going berserk.
Sees the cheese.
My dog sees the cheese and is like, oh, that's my high value cheese.
Right.
So then I go and I get some kibble to... give to the
mitigate
dog, not only to get them to be like, sorry that the cheese is going to the human, but also to calm her down so that she will not be barking the entire time while we're podcasting, because her older brother is at daycare and Stacy's at pottery class. So the little dog is just up there by herself. and I gave you a bunch of kibble, and I had a bunch of kibble in my hand, and I said, and I turned around and I said, well, the cheese is in my back pocket. And you reached in there, and apparently it was open. Yeah, wow, huh.
But I thought, but my, in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, that's so nice of Kirk. They pre-opened the
I'm just a terrible snack person. So,
which is, I don't know if that's...
My wife's a good snack person. I'm terrible with snacks.
My house is like 90% snacks. I don't really eat meals. I just eat snacks.
Okay. I need to stock up on snacks for you because I want to be that kind of host.
Because there's been a few times. I could bring my own snacks, but
No. I mean, you know.
Come in expecting snacks.
So the next topic in the ethical codes are boundaries of competence. Mm. So how much training and supervision does one need to be considered competent in this realm?
Boundaries of competence.
Yeah. So knowing your scope,
knowing
if you're competent enough to actually do a particular thing in therapy, right? And these are not set in stone. Of course, they are decided upon in the standard of practice. And it's not an easy question to answer. And I would pose it to them, maybe even start a discussion briefly for 5 minutes of what do you think would indicate that you, maybe it's something you do at the end of the course or something. Mm-hmm. Do you feel that you have enough competence to actually do this? And if so, how do you justify that if you were to be asked a question? And two, if you need more additional training or supervision, what would that look like? And, you know, it's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that question, honestly. I could see someone already having a lot of background, like Jungian therapy or other kinds of like art therapies are kind of in this area-ish, that you could potentially piggyback on that competence. But if you have like a CBT therapist that comes in, which I doubt will happen, but if they did and they're just out of graduate school and they take this, are they competent? I don't know.
I mean, I'm always fascinated that when I lead this training, there are people who are completely frozen. And I think like, how did you, especially that training, it takes them 3 months, you know, it sells out 3 months in advance. So I'm like, why did you decide to be here?
What do you mean? They're frozen, like they're terrified?
Yeah. I mean, they just look like they can't breathe.
Because they're scared of...
They're just over... Well, first off, who knows what it is? Are they overwhelmed by the completely art-based learning environment that I've set up? Did they have no idea that like they were... This was not going to be a dry lecture, but they were going to be playing for 6 hours straight.
Mm. So they're like shy and...
Yeah, they're like deer in the headlights. Like just like, you know, they're clearly not breathing. And I'm like... kind of hovering. I don't want to be like, you know, hey, just go for it, but just like, let me, you know, this might be new to you. Are there anything, can we make this any easier for you? Do you need to go? But there's this one person I'm thinking of in particular where I just thought they were going to vomit, and I was like, you know, get up, take a walk, come back. If this isn't the right training for you, I'm sure Cascadia would give you a refund. Like, they just, and they eventually got into it, but yeah, it is. The level of permission that I give in my trainings to be you, it's overwhelming for some people because our field can be very didactic. Mm. There is one way to do this. There is the right way to do this. I will teach you the right way. You will learn my way, and then you can use my name. You know, and that's not how I teach at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, I teach totally bottom up, like, hey, let's discover your way. Mm. Let's discover your inherent voice.
I'm sure people really appreciate you for that.
Yeah, I think that's why these...
That'd be half the benefit of going to the class, I bet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where I'm just like, hey, let's play. You know, if anybody out there knows the, you know, Montessori concepts of like, we learn best if we test it out ourselves.
Right.
Which can be really overwhelming for some people who like a very didactic style of learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's really great. I'm sure your students really appreciate that. Another part of competence is exactly what is one competent in with this form of therapy?
Right.
Is it the ability, you know, obviously the ability to predict the future, no one can claim competence with that. Is it the ability for self-exploration for the client? Mm-hmm. It seems like a pretty easy thing to state as a competence of this, of being good at this sort of form of therapy. You know, I might list out a few things of here is what you could claim to be competent in. Mm-hmm. Here are things that you cannot claim to be competent in because it's not true. And two, you can get sued if you say it. Now, if a client chooses to interpret it that way, that's fine. You know, you could have a client that could believe that this predicts the future for them and they make decisions based on that prediction that they are making, and maybe you're even collaborating on that, but that's up to the client, of course. Mm-hmm. And that's not something that you would propose to them in a strong way. You know, I don't know exactly all the different things that could happen. You know, you could see that people could take the training and really go a lot of different directions with this.
Yeah, and I mean, really, I see most. So there's a big fear in the art therapy world, and it's part of why I let my license lapse, and I do mention this every time I'm on the podcast that I let that license lapse, that there's a lot of fear in the art therapy world that like someone will take one course from us and steal all our ideas and we will be irrelevant. And I've always really fought very, very hard against that in the field, which is no one can take who you are individually as an art therapist. You bring magic into the environment. And I taught art therapy CEUs for, I don't know, 15 years. And mostly I learned that by teaching it to someone, they got really cautious in seeing how complex their own artistic experience was. And I'm seeing it also with the tarot work, that if a clinician takes one of my workshops, it's their first introduction to tarot. They've never done tarot before. Chances are very slim that they will use it with clients because it's so complex. So mostly it just becomes like an introduction for folks, and then it's really the clinicians who are like, I've been doing this for my own spiritual practice for 10 years, 25 years, I now want to slowly integrate it with clients. Those are the folks who like kind of make the bridge, because tarot is this massive undertaking. It's 78 cards. It's like, it's pretty big. And so, you know, I have yet to hear a story of anyone using it unethically. Obviously, I mean, I'm sure they're out there, but really, you know, we're talking about similar to any projective image, I don't want to say test or experience, where we let the clients mm-hmm. see an image, hear a couple of words, and see how that relates to their current experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's dream work is along these lines as mm-hmm. well. There's a long tradition of that.
Jungian.
Okay. Jungian. That's not the dream work that I do. I do, I guess, my own version of it. But
also narrative therapy as well.
Yeah.
If we were to tell a new story about this same old problem, introducing a new character, introducing a new scenario, how would the story look different?
Yeah.
Ooh, that's good. I gotta write that down.
So I would delineate that and say that whole thing to them, but also get concrete about, here is what I propose you try to achieve as a competence. And here is what I propose you actually not try to achieve as a competence. And that might be really reassuring to people from the beginning, on the outset. But you might also piss some people off because they're just like, well, but I believe in this. You know, like,
wait, this is so good. And I was writing the last idea. I got to write it again. What did you just say?
So you tell them, maybe at the very beginning, maybe even advertise as such, and then really go over this of, here's what I propose you attempt to achieve as a competence within tarot forms of therapy. And here are a set of things that I propose that you do not attempt to become competent in because of the following reasons. Like, if someone were to use Christianity in therapy, because people will do that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, tarot is not in that realm exactly, but it could be considered that in a certain, someone wanting to do tarot and someone that's doing tarot and as a therapy, similar to a Christian who wants a Christian therapist and a Christian therapist says, I do Christian therapy. There might be prayer, for example, mm-hmm. in the session. There might be talks of the Bible. There might be talks of what God might want from you, and spiritual practices, and navigating life through a Christian lens. And in that in those conversations, the ethics are such that you know, in terms of all we were talking about earlier about not imposing your values, about informed consent, all that kind of stuff, proper advertising, but you can't claim as a therapist that you are saving someone's soul, for example. You can't claim as a therapist that you know what God wants for them, right? And you could absolutely imagine a therapist crossing those lines. You can talk about even your own interpretation of the Bible, but you have to couch it in, that's just mine, you're free to have yours. You know, there's just a way of talking about these topics in therapy that can be within the realms of competence and ethics, and there's a way to have it not be that way. And that's a weird line, right? Like, where do you draw that line? But, you know, I'm sure that you do this really well, given my impression of your practice, is that you're certainly allowed to be yourself and to have your own beliefs, but you work collaboratively with the client, right? Like, you extract from the client where they want to go with it, and then you might suggest or add a little bit, but you're not going to impose, you're not going to bulldoze them. If they want to go in a certain direction with their art or tarot, then you go with them on that. And, you know, that's a weird zone to be in. but when you do it well enough, and maybe even working in like proper consultation and supervision measures to make sure that you're not going over the edge along those lines. Anyway, and then the next three topics are accurate advertising, which is self-explanatory, making sure that you state that there's limited evidence of this mode actually working, making sure that you state what it means and all that kind of stuff. Also, accurate representation. So if you are talking about this at a conference, or you are putting something in your disclosure statement, that you don't say something that is considered to be dubious in terms of its statements.
This will solve all problems for all clients.
Right.
Right.
Or I can tell your future.
Yeah.
And the last is scientific basis for treatment. We've kind of already been over this, but that when providing services, counselors and really all clinicians in the mental health field are, you know, supposed to use modalities that are grounded in theory and have a scientific foundation. There is evidence of Jungian therapy working, of course. You just have to not be within the tight realm of CBT, you know, randomized controlled trials. There's tons of studies demonstrating that Jungian therapy can be beneficial. So having those on hand and relating that can be a way to stave off liability if you're ever sued along those lines. Those are all the topics that I came up with.
This has been a masterclass. Thank you so much. I have several pages of notes, and just so everyone knows, I was writing so much my pen ran out of ink.
Oh, it did?
No, I'm good.
Oh.
I got it back, but you know. Yeah.
Those are my favorite pens.
What kind of pen is this?
What is it?
It's a Pilot Precise V5RT. If you want to write like Kirk does.
It's like
it's from Japan.
Oh, it is. It's a very smooth, ballpointy pen.
Well, and as a left-hander, I can often smear with the wrong type of pen.
Does that smear?
No,
because I could see it smearing.
This does not smear, which makes me like the Pilot Precise V5RT.
All right, let's take a break, and then we get back. Just one more email. What do you say?
I'm in.
All right, this next email is from patron Angel from Tucson. They say, have you seen about the new 988 suicide and crisis line number in the United States, dialing 988 instead of 911? There's been a lot of mixed messages and possible misinformation going around social media about how calling this number will result in the use of your geolocation, which will lead to inviting the police into your life, unknowingly or involuntary hospitalizations. I've read other numbers like this Trans Lifeline. I've read other numbers like this. The Trans Lifeline won't result in this, as they don't use your geolocation and don't work with the police. What have you gathered about the risks and benefits of using 988 number Rebecca, what do you think?
So I've heard a lot about it. It's, from what I've heard, it's great. I haven't heard any stories of police being involved. I would think the only reason they're using geolocation is to get someone in your state so that that person knows the state ethics, if at all possible.
Yeah.
I would say it's very safe and it's a really cool service because unlike your normal 911 operator who's trained for any multitude of issues, this person is specifically trained on suicidality.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to give a big 2 thumbs up for this service. And I'm sorry there's so much misinformation going on.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me. But yeah, I looked into it and you're right that the only geolocation that they use is to determine your local crisis line number because this isn't a national office. They want to connect you with your local suicide prevention professionals on the phone. So they do that, but they don't use your GPS to figure out where you're at. It's just I don't even know exactly how they do it. It might even be based on your telephone number or the cell phone tower or something. I don't know, but they figure out what office to route you to, and the person that answers the phone, they don't know where you are. You could be anywhere. Also, they don't call the police on you and I'll get into that in a second. And they certainly don't run out and detain you and put you in the hospital. Now, if you call this number and you indicate to the individual that you are imminently at risk of dying, then they will call 911 themselves. They will probably suggest to you that you call 911 yourself. Hmm. But if you don't do that, they do have potentially a moral responsibility, and it's certainly a legal and ethical responsibility to do what they can to help you get through this, which might involve calling 911. Now, presumably the suicide hotline professionals understand how to communicate to 911 such that the police are less likely to roll up with their guns out, right? So there's that. The other thing is, it's hard to know exactly the research on this because it's fairly new-ish, but we have a lot of data on this because this is just a new telephone number. It's not a new service. The service has been around for decades. The same people are working in these places. The number is just an easier way to get in touch with these people.
Yeah.
So we do have a lot of data along these lines, and very few people, like 1 or 2% of the callers, will cause the professional answering the phone to call 911. And a lot of times those are good for those individuals. It gets them the help that they need, gets them through that difficult time so that they can live and they can get the treatment and they can live a regular life. So this did not surprise me that these rumors are out there because this happens all the time. Mm-hmm. Why do you think these rumors are so quickly spread and so often spread along these lines?
I mean, I think people fear the worst, and that's obviously because the system has failed lots and lots of people. So when something good actually does show up, it's hard to believe that it's actually good. And I don't know quite how to... I know someone who's very involved in 988, so I'm really talking from personal experience. So I just, it's like heartbreaking for me to hear that things have landed, that this could be such a bad thing when really it's such a great thing.
Yeah.
But I think, the system has failed lots and lots of people, and we just expect that it's going to fail us, which, speaks to our experience. So I'm really glad this person wrote in so that, if there's anybody out there listening who had negative thoughts about this but hadn't tried it, I hope you will suggest this number to people.
Yeah.
It's really there to help.
Yeah. And even if you're not the one having the suicidal thoughts, it's a friend or someone else, you can call it yourself as well. They are there to answer your questions, connect you with resources, give you suggestions, talk you through it. They're there for a lot of different people who might need help. Yeah, absolutely. So that would be my guess as well about why these rumors are so often spread about services like this, that there have been people who have been harmed and murdered because of reaching out for help in these situations. And that does happen, and it's atrocious and criminal, and it needs to stop, and we need to train people and have systems in place, like 988, by the way, to help with that. And
because wouldn't you want to talk to somebody who is specifically trained,
right,
to address what's happening?
Yeah, and if anyone understands the landscape of that whole thing, the police, it's going to be these 988 people. Now, the other thing here is that what's highlighted in the media and online are the bad cases. Mm-hmm. And so you'll find people that just believe, well, if you are suicidal, you should never call anybody because the police are going to show up and shoot you. There are many, many examples of that happening. We understand that. But the vast, vast majority of the time, that doesn't happen. And those stories are never told, apparently.
Right.
No one ever tells those stories. It's like the same thing when you hear about CPS, Child Protective Services. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll be, never call Child Protective Services because they'll just come in and take your kids. Does that happen? Yes. Certainly, those cases are horrible, and, you know, meaning that it was not justified. But the vast, vast majority of the time, Child Protective Services, DSHS, are doing a good job. I worked side by side with them many, many times. Are there mistakes made? Is it a difficult situation, like kind of a no-win situation for a lot of these social workers? Yes. But I just want to put that out there. The other thing that I think is out there is the stigma of just about anything mental health. And I don't really have a well-articulated thought on this, but I'm going to briefly in two or three sentences summarize it. I think that we obviously know that there's stigma around mental health, and there's stigma around emotions, and stigma around vulnerability, and you know, all that, right? And so that's always been the case. But as we have more awareness in our society that that stigma is ridiculous, we don't actually shed the foundation of the stigma that anything mental health is disgusting or evil or scary or
dangerous.
Or dangerous.
Right? It's going to get out of control.
Right. So cognitively, you have a lot of people walking around knowing that that's not true, but their feelings are still there. And so they will have things like this that will come along. And so cognitively, they're like, okay, that's a good idea. But their heart is like, something is scary about that. Mm-hmm. And so they will either highlight things that are in agreement with that fear, and or when they're fed that information, they eat it up. They're like, yes, that feels right to me. I'm going to retweet that. I'm going to repost that because that's how it feels to me. And this happens a lot online. There are so many examples of this. And I think that is a better thing than we were before, where heart and mind were in agreement that all things mental health were bad, but we're not where we should be, where people have positive associations with mental health, mental wellness, professionals.
And that someone, there could be this idea that there could be a professional out there who could A, help you. So this happens to me all the time. I am somebody's first contact with the mental health system. This idea that like I am gentle and kind and funny and I have some things that could help you, instead of, you know, I'm going to make you feel worse or ashamed or, you know, all these things that
I'm going to pick your brain. I'm going to invade your brain.
Right. Or I'm only here to make you feel bad about yourself when actually I'm here to build you up.
Yeah.
And
TV shows and movies. Side note, have you seen Shrinking?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
The first episode made me so angry. I think I watched another couple episodes, but it was so stigmatizing to clients. Mm-hmm. It had that typical montage where you have 12 clients that are whiny, rotating through really quick.
Right.
Yeah, whiny about it, like ridiculous presenting problems, annoying presentations. And I just thought, you've lost me. Mm-hmm. You obviously, I don't know, like whoever wrote that thing, I feel like they had a few toes within the realm of realism, you know, realistic depictions of therapy and positive associations of therapy, but they still had, whoever wrote it and made this thing had a lot of toes in that old school anti-therapy realm. It was trying to do both. It was like trying to say we're pro-therapy but we also are anti-client or something. I don't know. Like, it was...
No bueno.
Yeah. It's like, as an Asian, being asked, where are you from? Like, if I just heard that one time in my life, I would say, oh, huh? Well, I'm from Issaquah, Washington. Where are your parents from? Spokane, Washington. Where are your grandparents from? Eastern Washington. You know, like, what are you getting at? You get asked that thousands of times, it gets on your fucking nerves. And the amount of fucking times that I see depictions of therapy in a TV show or a movie that are denigrating to clients and therapists, it's fucking aggravating, man.
And the offices are always too big and too fancy.
Way too expensive.
I know. Yeah. I'm like, fucking give that person an eighth of a space, a super tiny window, and no one's sitting in a comfortable chair, and then this show will be realistic.
Yeah, they always have a giant desk.
Oh, yeah, and a giant lavish couch and like a huge bay window. I mean, I have one of probably the biggest offices in Seattle.
Your office is big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not glamorous. I mean...
But it's sort of a catch-all for everything, because it's also your office with your desk, but it's against the wall.
Right. But like, most therapists are providing therapy basically in windowless closets. Yeah. So unless it's portrayed like that on TV, it's not realistic.
Right. Yeah. All right, Rebecca, does it for that episode.
I'm continuing on my Instagram challenge. We made it to 1,000 followers. Yay. At RTEXT, but the more you follow me, the better.
So our next goal is to get to 1,200.
Okay.
The magic of 12.
All right, I think
the archetype of, I'm sure Jung had something about the archetype of 12.
Well, there's 12.
The 12 tribes.
There's 12 tribes of Israel. Yeah.
So,
there's 12 signs in the zodiac.
So become part of that movement.
Yes.
Just to lock in. We used to count by 12. There were societies that were base 12, not base 10.
Well, we still have 12 hours in a day, which is strange.
Exactly. And we have dozens, you know.
Yes.
We go by dozens because you can divide 12 by 2, 3, and 4. And you can only divide 10 by 2 and 5.
Clearly not.
It's harder to break things up if you're trying to, you know, do fourths and eighths and all that kind of stuff.
I learned a lot today.
And everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because
you're so worth it. We like knowing you.